Hey, nanny, nanny.
Hey, nanny, nanny.
Zuzu Zay.
Zuzu Zay.
Zuzu Zay. Zuzu Zay.
Hey, rushing into us,
Zuzu Ryan. You got me in a sway, and I want to swing it done. Now you said it, no. Well, women come along. Zuzu Ryan.
Riot.
Throw back a bottle of beer. Get up in the Zuzu Ryan.
Riot.
Full of comb, full of coal black hair.
Zuzu Ryan.
Zuzu Ryan.
Throw back a
bottle of beer.
Zuzu Ryan.
Zuzu Ryan.
Pull a comb through your coal black hair.
There's still a million miles. There's still a million miles. There's still a million miles to go.
I've been a beggar and I've been a king. I've been a loner and I've worn the ring. Losing myself just to find me again. I'm a million miles smarter, but I ain't learned a thing. I've been a teacher and a student, a herd. I've kept my word for whatever that's worth. Never been last, but I've never been first. No, I may not be the best, but I'm far from the worst. No, I may not be the best, but I'm far from the worst. Oh, I've seen trouble more than any man can bear, but I've seen enough joy, I've had more than my share. And I'm still not done, I'm only halfway there. I'm a million miles ahead of where I'm from, but there's still another million miles to come. Searching for that city of gold. So I'm gonna follow this yellow brick.
I'll walk out there and do it. Thanks. So good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us. Before we get started, though, I do want to take a minute to speak to you about some events that were in the news today. Many of you saw it. So just to fill you all in, this morning, we got the news that a criminal investigation involving an admission scheme targeting universities across the nation has been ongoing. This is done by the Department of Justice, conducted by the Department of Justice, and it's revealed that there are dozens of individuals across the country charged with federal crimes. It affects Yale in the following way. They have identified a former women's soccer coach at Yale who apparently accepted a bribe in exchange for falsifying information about a student's application. At the moment, it looks like single coach, single student. We don't believe anybody else at Yale was involved, and of course, we're cooperating fully with the investigation, and will continue to do that. So I wanted to mention this to you because it is in the news today, and tell you that I'm quite angry and disturbed by this. We have core values, I think, of fairness, of inclusion in our mission admissions process, and an incident like this is an affront to those values. So I'll be taking actions necessary to make sure this can't happen again. And you'll probably hear more from me on this matter. Okay, let's now turn to our thanks for the support. Let's all now turn to three wonderful professors and a wonderful moderator who will talk to us about important discoveries coming from the Yale campus. I think you're going to enjoy what they have to say. Thanks very much, and I'll see you a little later in the evening.
This is Yale Explores, a community of lifelong learners coming together to examine and address the issues shaping our world and the biggest challenges of our time, so we can deepen our understanding today, teach and inspire the leaders of tomorrow, and innovate, collaborate, and accelerate positive change year after year after year. Drawing on the rich resources and heritage of Yale University and fueled by its faculty, students, and alumni, the thinkers, the doers, the creators, the discoverers, the boundary breakers, the difference makers, those committed to leading and serving, those who never stop exploring. This is Yale Explores. Welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome President Yale Club of San Francisco, Rahul Prasad.
Good evening. It is wonderful to see so many alumni, parents, and friends here tonight. Not a seat empty in the house. I think that tells us clearly that the Yale community here in San Francisco is flourishing and thriving. I have the privilege of serving as the president of the Yale Club of San Francisco. And on behalf of the club leadership, I am delighted to welcome you to this Yale Explorers event. We are pleased to co-sponsor tonight's event with a lot of other organizations with Yale, the Yale Alumni Association, the Yale Club of Monterey, the Yale Club of Sacramento, the Yale Club of Silicon Valley, the Graduate School Alumni Association, and a number of shared interest groups. We are all a part of the Yale Alumni Association, and we welcome your input and contributions towards making us a stronger organization in the months and years to come. I hope you've all had a chance to visit our new website and to explore everything that the YAA has to offer. I hope you enjoyed the reception as much as I did, connecting with old friends as well as meeting fellow Yalies. Please stay after the program for more food and drink and the opportunity to interact with tonight's presenters. And don't forget to take a photo in the Yale Explorers photo booth. Representatives of the clubs and the shared interest groups will also be available during this reception. If you're new to the area or want to get connected to any of these organizations, please be sure to stop by the Get Involved table at the front of the house. Tonight's presenters exemplify the groundbreaking interdisciplinary collaborations that are a hallmark of Yale. Shelley Kagan is the Clark Professor of Philosophy at Yale. Professor Kagan's work focuses on the nature of well-being, morality, and utopia. Professor Kagan is a popular lecturer at Yale, known for his introductory lectures on death and ethics. Laurie Santos is a professor of psychology and the head of Silliman College. Professor Santos's research explores an age-old question: what makes the human mind unique? Her class, Psychology and the Good Life, is the most popular class in Yale's history. She is currently working on a podcast called The Happiness Lab that will be released later this summer. Brian Scarsellati is a professor of computer science and of mechanical engineering and material science. Professor Scarsellati designs robots who assist with the developmental progression of children with autism. His interests include humanoid robots, human-robot interactions, artificial intelligence, machine perception, and social learning. Tonight's moderator, Margaret Warner, currently serves as a senior fellow at Yale's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. She recently stepped down from a post as the chief global affairs correspondent for PBS. She joined the NewsHour in 1993 after working as a political White House and diplomatic correspondent for Newsweek magazine and the Wall Street Journal. Ms. Warner is a graduate of Yale College, as well as a former trustee of the university. We are also fortunate tonight to have President Peter Salovey He will close the discussion with insights on tonight's topics from the perspectives of a social psychologist, highlighting Yale's unique ability to address these challenging issues. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Warner and Professors Kagan, Santos, and Scazzolati to the stage for Yale Explores Being Human in the Age of Intelligent Machines.
Thank you, Raul. Thank you so much. And it's such a delight to be here in San Francisco with all these Yalees, parents, and alumni. I'd always imagined performing before such an audience, but I could never even get into an a cappella group. So this is my opportunity. The topic at hand, of course, being human in the age of intelligent machines, is very hard to get our arms around. But we absolutely have to, as many of you in this audience know, as the chief scientist at the research division of Baidu, which, again, I don't need to explain, is sort of the Google of China, said essentially that AI is the new electricity. In other words, just as electricity transformed every industry and every interaction, AI is now going to do the same. Now, we're all reading every day stories related to artificial intelligence, the legal issues, the political issues, the privacy questions. Tonight, we're going to focus really on the human issues. And what does it mean to be human now, and what will it mean in the age of intelligent machines? The question, of course, draws from philosophy, psychology, as well as technology. And we have this dazzling trio of Yale faculty, all of whom are doing groundbreaking work in this subject. And so we're just going to jump right into it. Since we expect, of course, Raul explained this, but afterwards you can follow up with any of them. Now let's first watch a brief video made by a freelance filmmaker about 6 years ago about the work going on at the Yale Robotics Lab.
Oh, you win. Yes, I win.
There's a change that's been happening in robotics in which robots have traditionally been used as tools, and now they're becoming more companions and social partners.
We have tied this round. Oh, you win.
We built a robot to play rock, paper, scissors, and it honestly gets to be quite boring after a little while. And so we would introduce something that changed, something new, to see whether or not it would cause people to treat it more like a person.
I won.
Yes, I win.
I don't think so. You've changed your hand position.
The robot would cheat by changing the gesture that it had thrown. And they suddenly responded to the robot as if it were a person out to get them.
It's not fair.
And so cheating makes a machine seem more like a person.
Yes, I win.
Even the smallest bit of social response is enough to get us engaged, get us motivated, and really grab our attention.
And so I'm going to pose first to Skaz, as he likes to be known, to explain what he meant. What did you mean when you said right at the top of that film, very cheerfully, that in the past, robots were essentially tools. Now they're becoming really companions and social partners. Why do we want to do that?
Well, first, I'm going to lie completely so you'll all know that I'm really a human. no, I think in the tradition of robotics, and especially in mechanical design, robots were automata. They were things that did something repetitively over and over again, without having to make a lot of decisions or without actually having to engage with people. And that was how we thought about building robots for many decades, but that is changing. And today we have robots in homes, and we have robots in schools and hospitals and all over the place. And as we're starting to see robots come out into the real world, the human world, we're starting to think differently about the way we design them. And so these machines are not just taking some dull and repetitious job and performing that over and over again, but in some ways are starting to fill very different roles. And that's
but why is that a good thing? Why do we want machines to act more like humans, try to fool humans, get the humans to react to the machines?
I think in many cases, we're not just trying to make them like people. And in fact, the idea that we're going to build machines that look like us, that act like us, that's not always what we're going for. But there are some roles that robots can play that allow us to do something that we couldn't do before. Much of the work in my lab right now focuses on work with children with autism. And we build robots that do in-home therapy for kids with ASD. And these robots are what you would love to have if you were wealthy enough and influential enough to have a therapist in your home for an hour a day. And it doesn't take the place of a person, but it gives the family a little bit of support. It keeps the kids engaged and motivated in doing their therapy. And in fact, it's something that both the families love. And so there are these places where we're starting to see we might be able to provide technology-based solutions where we don't have people with the income to be able to accomplish it, or we just don't have enough trained people to be able to fill that role.
Skaz, so you don't currently envision these things replacing people, but
true.
Push out 20 years or 30 years, how much is that what we're aiming for?
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases, we're not. There are certain places where machines are going to change our employment landscape. And if you're a truck driver, learn a new trade right now. Because that's an area where we're going to see automation take over. And we're going to see that within the span of years, maybe a decade, maybe two. But there are so many other things where the limits of these technologies are so substantial, and what we're able to accomplish with them, that even in the foreseeable future, we're not looking at really replacing people.
Let me get Laurie to jump into this about the psychology. We saw those two. Those are Yale students. They knew they were doing an experiment in the robotics lab, and yet they talked to this machine as if he or it were human. What's the psychology behind this?
I think one of the reasons that Skaz's robots are so successful is that they're able to tap into this incredibly ancient psychology. Like this psychology that tells us that thing over there is a machine or that thing over there is some physical thing I don't have to pay attention, as opposed to that thing over there is an agent and it can have emotions. It can have goals toward me that could be positive goals or negative goals. Like that psychology is the kind of thing that I see in work with monkeys. These are the kinds of things that creatures who are like our evolutionary cousins have. It's also the set of psychological mechanisms we see incredibly early on in life. There's some research at Yale by the researcher Karen Wynn, who's a professor in my department in psychology, who's been trying to look at how young very human babies can detect the sort of thing that you saw in those robots. Can babies detect when agents are trying to be nice or trying to be mean or trying to cheat? And what she finds is that even within the first 6 months of life, babies are already picking up on A, which objects out there are agents, like which are just physical things and which are things that have goals and so on, but B, when are those agents nice versus mean? And those are abilities that kick in the first 6 months of life. And so I think one of the things that makes these robots so successful is you're able to tap into these incredibly basic, deeply evolved mechanisms. And once robots do that, then it doesn't take much work. Then you see what you see in that video, where students, you know, they can't help but react as though this is another agent, a person, as it were.
Because the things are cheating. I don't just mean in terms of the game, but they're cheating, they're abusing the systems, right? I mean, we all know that if you see a cloud with a couple of dots here and a little stroke there, we'll see it as a face, right? We're evolved to see faces every place, and so we're evolved to see agency even where it's not. And I suppose that raises then the danger that your machines, your robots are not just doing something helpful, but they're potentially manipulating people.
And it is something that we worry about because the two students that you saw in this, Sam and Carolyn, they, in fact, were part of my research team. They knew the robot was going to cheat. They were expecting that it was going to cheat. And they still felt themselves drawn in. We exploit these basic elements of psychology in order to get these effects.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
I am sometimes. I say during a good time that, you know, on a good day, what I do is I build robots that help kids. And on a bad day, what I do is I build robots that manipulate children into doing things they don't want to do. But on both days, we still get these effects, and they still last for almost, you know, hours at a time. When we ran this original experiment, we brought in hundreds of undergrads, and many of them, even though the robot would cheat only once, they'd still be talking to the robot 30 minutes later. 30 minutes, Shelley, and they're still talking to it. It
Shelley,
never says anything else.
So as a philosopher, shouldn't we be, aren't you worried about this? Or what are the ethical problems out there?
Well, there's any number of them. I mean, one of which is just this thought that it's easy to imagine, I mean, maybe not 10 years down the road, maybe not 20 years down the road, but, you know, clearly some point down the road, we're going to have things that can simply convince us that they're people. Now, I'm perfectly prepared to believe there'll be another stage even further down the road when they will be people, not Homo sapiens, not biological members of our species, but creatures like you all who can think and believe and make their own plans and the like. Interesting questions happen once we get there. Initially, I'm worried about the stage in between when it fools us into thinking they're that and they're not yet.
But I think we're basically already there now. I mean, take cases like Alexa, right? I mean, I don't know how many of you have this in your home, but I mean, if you're like me, you might have these intuitions where it's kind of bad to unplug her, like when you go away for vacation, right? You have this moment, and you're like, is she going to be mad or whatever? When she messes up, you get really pissed off at her, right? You know, when she does something dumb, you're like, why are you such an idiot, right? And so, again, I know she's just an algorithm, but she's fooling this incredibly basic psychology.
Right. And then when she starts saying, Laura, you really hurt my feelings, please order something from Amazon to make me feel better.
Yeah. We're months away from this dangerous moment, I think. Yeah.
Not too far, I don't think. Well, Laura, how does it affect human interaction already, and how do you anticipate it could, the fact that we tend to, I don't know, humanize these machines?
Yeah, I mean, I think I worry about lots of different things with these machines. One is that we're humanizing them, right? And that means they capture our attention in a way that other physical objects don't, right? When I interact with my Alexa, I interact with her differently than I interact with my toaster, because she talks to, I mean, really, right? She talks to you, she answers, we can have these conversations, she has information that it feels like she kind of knows. It kind of feels like sometimes she's helping me and sometimes she's being annoying. And all those things mean that she's capturing my attention in a very different way than most other physical objects. And I actually worry about that more than the cheating and the exploiting the psychology part. We have devices in our lives now that capture our attention in a way that no other devices in human history have done. And I don't even think we need to get into like robotic tech like the stuff you saw in the video. I think just the simple phones that many of you have in your pocket are grabbing your attention in just those ways. They're not, I mean, Siri talks to you, I guess, but your phones are probably not talking to you right now. But even my mention of them, for some of you in the audience, are going to make you be like, oh, where is that right now? Should I check my email right now? And that's your psychological system interacting with the device in a really different way. And I worry what that's doing to our psychology. I worry what it's doing to our learning, to our social relationships. I think we just don't know yet.
And those things are relatively stupid in terms of where we're headed.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's not... you know, the fact that my iPhone, which is a very old iPhone, by the way, has on the other side of it, you know, every email I've ever sent, every cat video on the internet, the entire collection of every art gallery in the world, every song I might ever want to sing, it's a really interesting thing that can capture my attention. And, you know, I am having great conversations with you, but, like, you know, this conversation needs to be really stimulating to compete with everything else on the other side of these devices. And that's a device that's not talking to us, it's not interacting, it's not cheating. Like, we are up against technology.
That's a very high bar, Laura. I'm not sure I can meet that.
I know. So many people in the audience just pulled out their phone, they're like, yeah, it's boring. Like, cat videos, yay!
You know, though, I got to take the side of the technology for just a minute and say, this is something that isn't new. We've been building technology to try to grab people's attention and to manipulate what choices they make. We call that politics and marketing. That's what we do. We try to manipulate each other into doing things, and the fact that we use one medium or another, that's still the same effect that's happening. Now, it is true that we're building that at a scale and at a rate of release that's very different than what we were once doing. But I don't think that that story has changed much.
I think it's the scale that I worry about a lot. Let me just give one study that I find really harrowing, honestly. This is some work by Liz Dunn, who's looking at just the simple social effects of having your phone. Again, not a crazy robot that's talking to you, just your phone. And what she finds is that having your phone on a table in a conversation, even if it's out and you never use it, will reduce the amount that you smile with other individuals that are around you. It'll reduce your enjoyment of a conversation. Again, because I think, you know, part of you is like, I could be watching these cat videos. And like, those they're small effects, but you know, you put these things in 6 billion in pockets, you know, we've just done this at a scale that I don't think we know the consequences of it.
Yeah, I agree. There's really a rate of release for these technologies that we have to find some way to deal with. But the potential for good is there as well. I have a student right now who's in Korea at one of our major conferences presenting a paper about how a robot can actually influence the behavior of people in a meeting to get them to pay attention to those individuals who aren't speaking up, to get them to make sure that everyone is being included in the conversation.
How does that work?
By monitoring the conversation and by using social cues to turn the attention to someone else. So Shelley's been quiet for a few minutes,
yes,
unusually. And, and so suddenly the robot is looking at Shelley, and suddenly everyone else is looking at Shelley.
But that would take away my job. That's exactly what I do. I thought I could never be replaced. These moderators,
not just truck drivers.
But the trouble with that, I mean, one of the problems with the robot doing that is you're going to trust it to be fair. And then, of course, if it's got some algorithm running that makes it favor men over women or women over men, then it's going to be directing the conversation in ways that we may not even pick up on because its job is to be fair and just like Margaret.
And then you all will start reacting in that way. You know, yelling, yeah, talking louder, mocking the other participants.
That's my job.
Yeah. That's your job.
I believe I've already demonstrated it. Though,
so let me jump to something else. And it's an extreme one, but what's usually called the Terminator syndrome. The idea that what makes, and you can correct me, any of you, if I'm wrong about this, that what makes a computer, an AI machine, different from an ordinary computer is that it is, quote, self-teaching. Now, this audience probably already knows what that means, but essentially it learns by sucking in as much data, recognizing patterns, right? And that, well, explain the idea of that it's self-teaching.
Sure. In a lot of AI and what we call machine learning, the idea is that the machine is not performing one constant function, but rather is using the data that it's acquired to change what it's doing in the future. And we've seen various forms of that for many years now. But what's new, really, is the amount of data that we're able to apply to these techniques and the way in which we've been able to leverage that to work on some real-world problems. And so when you see when you post something on Facebook and it suddenly recognizes who's in that photo, or when you're walking outside and you see that self-driving car rolling down the street. These are machine learning systems in a very practical, real sense.
But what's the doomsday scenario, the scary one?
Well, and the scary scenario is that in many of these cases, the underlying algorithms and the way that they work are very much opaque. That they are doing something, but we can't look inside them, and we can't explain why they've come to a particular conclusion. And that's the thing that I think gets people worried at this point.
So in the Terminator movies, of course, the problem is that, you know, the machines are busy trying to wipe out the humans deliberately. I mean, they've been sent back, you know, to do that. I imagine the worry that more of us are worried about isn't that. It's when they become idiot savants. They'll be extraordinarily good at something, but won't have the full array of intelligence and common sense that we take for granted. And so we give them some task, and they think of a shortcut that we never in a million years would have occurred to us that they might take, and now they've completely messed things up big time.
And that shortcut violates all kinds of principles that we would consider basic humanity. Right? I mean, what's one of the examples that the machine's been programmed, or the team of machines, to come up with a way to eliminate some disease on the face of the earth. And if it hasn't been programmed properly, it could just say, well, wipe out everybody who has that
and
or carries
no
the gene. And then, yeah.
Just so.
I mean, that's a foolish example, but isn't there a danger that if we, the creators of this, I'm speaking in a broad sense, don't have some control over how the machine figures out how to get from A to X, that's something to be worried about? Or should we say, how wonderful, we've programmed all this stuff into them, and then they're coming up with creative solutions?
So there's an example, some years old, but I think it also just illustrates the point, that my daughter brought to my attention, where they were teaching a program to learn how to land planes. Mm-hmm. And there was some device that would mark how strong the landing was, right? And so the idea that the programmers had was, the hope was that it would learn to land the plane very, very smoothly. And the AI system figured out that if it landed really, really hard, really made the plane crash with a vengeance, the device that was measuring that couldn't detect it at all. So it gave that perfect score. That's a real worry.
And is that a true case or just theoretical?
I gather this was a true case. This is not my area. I don't know. Skaz, can you confirm this?
I do not know that we've actually been crashing planes deliberately.
It was a simulation that it wasn't yet in charge of the planes. It's that, what if this kind of behavior had not shown up during the simulation runs and it hadn't learned how to game the system until it actually was landing planes on autopilot? That's one of the worries.
So, Lori, let's take self-driving cars as we know them today. What are your thoughts about the effect on humans that broad use of self-driving cars will have? In other words, the humans say, oh, phew, now I can read a book and I can do this and this. Or how does the human react that he or she doesn't have control? Talk to us about that.
All these technological advances we're talking about, they're going to be enormous benefits, but potentially problematic costs, right? And I think with self-driving cars, you know, this is great. We can fix traffic. We can probably reduce errors because a lot of errors and accidents come from human errors. But that means you're driving this device that could potentially be a lethal device that's been programmed to make certain decisions. And because of the way these devices learn, and just because of, you know, who's going to be in them, you might not know what those decisions are. Like, you might not know the if-then statements that this system's using to make those decisions, and they might not be yours. And most of the time, that's just silly. You know, most of the time, that could be, you know, you want to go a certain speed, and, you know, like, I really, really want to get to this party on time, and the, you know, self-driving car's like, no, we don't go over the speed limit. And you're like, come on, please, hold. You know, it could be something silly like that, but it could be, you know, more difficult cases. You know, a little kid runs out in the middle of the road, and this self-driving car has to decide whether or not to hit that child or, you know, to swerve off and potentially injure the passengers in a car, right? I mean, these are the decisions that these types of devices are going to have to be making. And ultimately, we get into the domain, in cases where it's human life is involved, into moral decisions, right? And, you know, these have historically been the purview of other humans. You know, do we want these to be the kinds of things that algorithms are making, and even algorithms that you might not be able to understand? Like, you don't know what's under the hood in that scenario.
Earlier this afternoon, the four of us were talking about this issue a little bit, and I posed a certain problem, a moral dilemma, to Margaret, and she voted a certain way. You know, what do you think the right thing to do would be in such and such a case? And I pointed out to her that her own view is, although a familiar one, it's the minority view. The vast majority of people that get asked about this case vote another way. So Marga could find herself in her purchased self-driving car, which is suddenly behaving in a way that she herself personally feels is unethical, making the wrong choices in terms of who to damage, who to hurt, if an accident is inevitable.
And those are the moral domains. I actually worry about those, but I also worry about cases of just restricting human freedoms, right? I mean, self-driving cars will be able to pick up on statistics of all kinds of stuff, right? You know, imagine a self-driving car that gets a little funding from some particular fast food joint, right? And if it has a choice of which direction to take you on the way to the party, you go by that particular fast food joint that paid the self-driving car, right? I don't think we're outside the realm of possibility when we think of these kinds of things.
Of course, your cab driver can already do that, right?
Yeah, but my cab driver, I guess all these problems can be human problems, but I think they're scarier when they're under the hood, and they're scarier when they're part of a like infrastructure that gets advertising revenue that may or may not be exactly in cahoots with my preferences. Like part of it is I have preferences about where I want to eat, how I want to go, moral decisions I might like to make, and it's hard for me to know what those preferences are in the these technologies.
Do you feel differently about this case than when you get on an airplane? You know, presumably as well, the pilot's got some set of rules that they're governing, you know, that they're abiding in terms of should some crisis actually happens, you know, where would they land, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I imagine you could not look up United's policy about who are we going to kill when we have to, when, you know, who, who don't we let have a life raft, you know? Do you feel anxious that that decision was made out of your
I don't. And I think, I mean, my intuition there is that they're about decisions that I would have been making 10 years ago, right? And in theory, if I had to come to it, I could ask United what that policy was. And I think with some of these technologies, we don't even
know
what they are.
I mean,
so I think it's even a little more than that, though, because I think in some of these cases, these are human ethical dilemmas posed at the question of what would the machine do. But along with the same way that we have cell phones in almost everyone's pocket now, we also suddenly face the case where suddenly this isn't just a single individual moral or ethical dilemma, but rather we could have one consistent system that was being deployed at such a large scale where we suddenly have to worry about what are the overall implications if everyone is doing this? And what all of our choices right now are predicated on the idea that you as an individual are making a choice and I might make a different choice. But that may not be true.
Good. So we have the notion of the marketplace of ideas.
Exactly.
But if the technology is making all the choices, then you don't have that same ability to have kind of labs trying different things out for science.
Skaz, I want to get you in on another sort of aspect of this, and it has to do with, you know, human agency, human independence. So a couple of weeks ago, we were all talking about your mother has dementia. She's in a lovely assisted care facility. Someone's waiting for her, but she's been over for dinner. And so you help her into the self-driving car, and it's told exactly where to take her, to not stop, and to totally ignore what she says, and you lock the doors, or the car locks itself. Just even in that, what are the issues that raises?
Yeah. And this is, again, a question that is much more a question about us and how we feel about using this, not a question about the technology itself even. The technology is enabling this question, but these issues that we're going to encounter as we are able to turn over certain tasks to these machines, how do we feel about turning over that task to the machine? Do I feel okay with the idea that I'm putting my mother in a car where she might say, stop, stop, there's a child in front of us, and I've told the car to ignore her? Or she might say, let's go shopping right now, and I've told the car to ignore her. Or how do we feel about the idea that I'm turning over care of my mother to this device? And all of these questions are much more about us than they are about the technology itself.
And that the machine is offering, or the self-driving car, great convenience. And where, how do we trade, you know, that off? And again, it's about what we think.
Yeah, Laura.
I mean, can I jump in on that? Because I think that this is, I mean, again, this is something that we've been doing with technology for a long time. This is not just started like, oh my God, self-driving cars, now we're trading convenience for, you know, human freedom, these other things. I mean, you can look back at all these cases of technology where in a lot of cases we're either handing off our freedom or often handing off like parts of our humanity. Like the simple act of being social, talking to other people, I think we do that less because we have so much tech around us all the time. You know, think of things like Uber or like, you know, these cashiers that you can just go to, or even like a simple ATM machine. You know, we're slowly removing these minutes that we talk to other people. And that's kind of part of our humanity. There's a question about like what we're doing as a society at large when we remove these kinds of tiny things, you know, especially in this age where, you know, loneliness is on the rise. You know, loneliness is thought of as a public health threat. It's as bad for you as smoking 15 cigarettes a day, right? You know, like is the convenience of all this tech we have removing these subtle moments of social interaction?
But look, so I think B.F. Skinner says someplace that, you know, no doubt when we first invented washing machines, and this was displacing the people who were doing the washing by hand, This was horrible, right? You're not interacting with the laundress, et cetera, et cetera. I take it nobody thinks now, looks back and say, oh, woe is me, you know, we don't interact with the laundress. So I don't miss the minutes I'm not spending talking to the cashier at the bank. It would be if this became everything that we're doing.
Shelley, right? did you just come to the defense of technology here?
Yeah.
It's a very strange dynamic.
I'm sleep deprived, Skaz. Okay.
But that's the point, though, is that we don't miss it. But in some ways, I think what a lot of cognitive science teaches us is we don't necessarily notice what we're not getting until we see some problem, right? Like, you know, think of this loneliness epidemic, right? I mean, why is it that this is rising if we're not missing something critical? And so I think that's the problem is our minds forecast like, oh, the convenience is going to be so great. But then in practice, maybe it might not.
No, I mean, I think the image we have, I'm not just an image, right? I take it these things happen where people are sitting in the room with each other, each looking at their cell phone instead of having a conference. Then something's gone wrong. So I'm not sure it's the ATM
point is like,
machines.
Yeah, so maybe ATM, like, okay, I don't have to talk to the bank teller. But, you know, where's our limit here, right? And you know, the devices we have, I mean, you saw the examples of what's coming, and I think what's coming is worse. Like, the cell phone of the future is going to be much more addictive than the cell phones right now. And right now, we can't put them away. I mean, I have trouble putting them away at dinner, right? So, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, like, where are we on this path?
Well, for my fellow panelists know that the solution to
Shelley
that
is
to
immune.
Have,
yes.
have
yeah.
your...
Yes.
I think we're also, though, going to see that this isn't just a single dimension that we're going to be trading off on, but rather there's going to be many different things, and not everyone is going to have the same answers.
That's right.
There was a survey a few years ago that was conducted both in the U.S. and Europe and in Japan, and the question was, if you could have a robot that lived in your home or lived in the home of your elderly parents and helped them carry out day-to-day tasks, would you buy it for them? And the universal response in Japan was, this is fantastic. The seniors said, this is going to help me stay in my home longer, live the way I want to. This is going to make it so that I'm not becoming a burden to my children. The middle-aged generation said, of course, this is something that's going to help my parents. Why wouldn't I want to provide for them? In the US, the answer was completely the opposite. It was, why would I want a machine to take care of my parents? That's my job. That's inhumane to be doing this. And it's not that one of these is right and one's wrong.
Well, and it's not so terrible that one society might prefer one and another, is it?
I think that's fine. I'm just saying, I think it's not going to be just one easy choice that we make, but rather we're going to be trading off the benefits that we have and the potential deficits.
But I think it goes beyond the, okay, so this culture picks this way, or even within a culture, you know, these people vote this way, these people vote that way. I mean, part of, I think, what gives us our sense of self-worth is being appreciated and validated by other people. I could make that point in a lot of obscure philosophy jargon, but I think it's a fairly straightforward point. When you've got the robot that looks like it's validating somebody, but isn't actually validating somebody, then something's gone wrong.
And I think this gets back to the psychology question, where I think the hope is that designers who are making these technologies know enough about what are the super ingredients in social interaction that we need to put into the robot. But I actually think, I mean, social science is an early, like, we're just still a new science. I think we don't know. I think we are consistently surprised by the stuff you have to get in there. Those of you who remember your intro psych remember this classic case of Harlow's monkeys. So this was an experiment to try to see, like, you know, what do monkeys actually need in life? And the idea is, like, just food, they'll be fine. And what you find is that monkeys actually, I mean, yes, they need food or else they'll die, but they also need just something soft to cling to. So if you have the so-called wire mother who gives food and nothing else, you get monkeys who are, you know, not socialized, not growing up. And I think, you know, we know that with wire mothers now, but, like, you know, what's the secret sauce in your elderly caretaker robot that you need? You know, like what could we be missing by using a machine? I think we could get the answer to that. And once we do, we'll be able to develop devices that do all the right stuff. But if we're missing the right answer, we might be missing something critical.
But aren't we, just part of that, aren't we now working on trying to program these AI machines so that they can read your voice, how you're moving to discern your emotional state. Right now, they don't have that ability. Is that right?
And there are, you know, a lot of technology-based work to try to understand more about what's happening with a person, to understand their intentions, their emotions, mm-hmm. their thoughts, what they know, what they don't know. When we build tutoring systems, figuring out whether the student understands this basic concept of geometry or not is something that the machine tries to infer. But this is all, you know, very much, you know, if the social psychology of it is in its infancy, mm-hmm. we're, you know, in our first 3 seconds of life here.
It's really our fault that we haven't figured it out
for you. If you just figure it out first, then we'll
More funding, I think, is what you meant to say.
Yes, I think more funding.
But it's even more than that. So the example that you saw in the video with, you know, the robot cheating, that's one that we couldn't easily do with humans because it relies on the fact of you playing these games over and over again and relying on the fact that you don't really know whether this thing you should treat it as an agent or you should treat it as a toaster. And because we can force people to make these decisions, we're uncovering new things all the time as we build them.
But I want to go back to something that Laurie said, which is, you know, if we don't know enough, then we can end up making caretakers, automated caretakers that mess up their charges. And that's your point about the Harlow and the monkeys. But that just means we need to make them better. That still leaves untouched the worry that you don't want it to be the case that the person that you think loves you only loves you because they're programmed to give you that warm glow of loving you. You know, you bought the helpmate 2026, right?
It might be
you could be fooled into not even knowing that it was programmed to love you.
Why would you care then?
No, but it might be that the special sauce is that it's authentic. I mean, it might be that the special sauce is that it's someone who's related to you, right? Like someone who's grown up with you that you care for, right? And so, I mean, I think we're basically probably saying the same thing ultimately, which has never happened, so it's really great. But which is that, like, the meaningful part.
I disagree with you, Laurie. We're not saying the same thing.
No, but we might not be, there might be things that are just really tough to build into these systems, not because we don't understand the social psychology, but because you cannot build it into it because it is by definition a non-person, perhaps. Is
right. Does that make it
less manipulative then? And maybe that would be great, that we can't get there anyway, and we use it as a helpmate and as a, you know, as a helpmate. But if it will never be able to be more than that, then that would make us safe from that.
I wasn't myself thinking we'll never be able to do more than that. So what Laurie just thought was maybe the secret sauce, to use your phrase, is that you've actually got to be a person, not a flesh and blood person, you know, a steel and wire person. But it's okay. I mean, I think philosophically it's okay if the validation comes from something that actually has values, actually can make choices, can say, you know, you've got something, Laurie, that makes me want to spend time with you, where that wasn't just built in that it was going to say that. So if the simulation can't get there until it's the real deal, that's okay.
But then Shelley, this raises the question about, now you're saying what? There'll be a machine that actually has feelings, that has desires, that has wishes?
That's certainly what I think. Of course, I don't do facts, so I don't know, Scott.
Boy, I don't even know where to take that one. I'm suddenly the expert on facts here. This is a whole new thing.
We got two fact people here, right? Okay.
So I think there are, you know, it is inevitable that when we look at some of these devices and we see them taking action in the world and we see them making obvious choices of doing one thing versus doing another thing, our brains are designed to infer certain things about them and infer that they have these internal states and whether they have, we think of them as beliefs or desires or knowledge, that is what we as humans do. And we do it with everything. We don't just do it with robots. We do it with our cars. How many of you will admit to thinking that your car was angry with you because it broke down, right? We do it with our plain old computers. And when that thing crashes for the third time in a row, you know it's out to get you. And we do it with everything. And that's just what we are as humans.
So we ascribe beliefs, desires, goals, emotions to all sorts of things where it seems to me it's not yet the case that they have beliefs, desires, and emotions. But that's not to say that technology won't get to the point. I certainly see no reason to think that we can't. I mean, I'd be shocked if there was something magic about being made out of carbon that allowed you to have feelings.
Laurie, you just got to jump in on this.
No,
I mean,
no, I mean,
as the expert in what makes people, human.
I'm not the expert
happy.
In what makes a person
you are
a person.
Happiness. But do you think that we could have, it could be designed, a machine that has a sense of happiness?
I mean, I definitely think, to kind of echo what Skaz was saying, I think there are definitely machines we could design that we think have a sense of happiness, right? So two different possibilities on the table. One is kind of what Brian's saying, which is like, look, it doesn't matter whether or not that machine is a person. You think it's a person automatically, right? Like later you could rationalize it and stop it and so on, but you're going to have with that machine the same reaction as those people in the video. You're going to act like it has morals. You're going to act like it's being fair or unfair. Like that's the human psychology. I think there's a separate question of what it would take for them to really be a person, to really have intentions, to really have choices and beliefs and so on. And that's just not something that trips up our human psychology. That's like actually being an agentive creature that has this stuff.
Full blown
personhood. Yeah. And I think Shelley's point is like, we might get there. I actually don't know. I think we could debate whether or not we're going to get there. But I think once we get there, if we were to get there, now we're in a different zone. Because now we have created these things that, getting back to my Alexa, is not just like, I kind of feel bad when I unplug her. Yeah. If she's really a person, then I should feel bad when I unplug her.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Once we get something like that, you can't unplug it. That's murder.
Right.
I think that's a sign of how far we are from it. I mean, that it seems a silly suggestion, but in fact, it seems to me once you've got an automated system that has beliefs, has desires, has goals, has feelings, it counts, my own view philosophically, is it counts the same way that you do. And just like if I were to come to you and want to turn you off, you would take umbrage at that thought, and rightly so. We will need to cross a divide where we stop thinking of these things as really, really fun, fancy toys. They'll be people. That's the term that philosophers use when we're trying to talk about these full-blown agents, but not necessarily Homo sapiens. In the same way that you would, you know, if we landed on Mars and discovered Martians, we would think, you know, to destroy one of them would be murder. I think eventually, at least in principle, technology could get to the point where it would be immoral to turn it off.
But that's not to say that we should stop worrying about things until we get to that point.
No, that's right.
Because we all agree that long before that, these things are going to have an impact on us, and we need to worry about that as we're designing them. There was a researcher who built a robot as an experiment that would play games with children, and then at the end, a white lab coat, experimenter would walk in and would say to the child, "Great job, you've done fantastic," and then would say to the robot, "Robot, you did an okay job, but now it's time for you to go get in the closet." And the robot would turn to the child and say, "Don't let them put me in the closet. It's dark and scary in the closet."
How did this get past the IRB?
Yeah. This was not at Yale.
This was not at Yale. Yale. I don't know how it got out of past, but that has a real impact. You can imagine the impact of it.
These kids are still scarred 20 years later. Yeah. Just,
All right, now another problem we talked about, go back to the car and has to make this split-second decision. And we talked about, well, you can't have the wrong choices programmed in. Who does the programming? Who writes the algorithm?
I imagine.
I'm voting for Shelley.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I know absolutely nothing about coding, right? So is it okay if I make up the rules and
please,
pass
absolutely.
That along to somebody else?
That's
to actually, right? Presumably it'll be somebody working on some obscure lab in Google, right? Anybody
raise
here work in that lab? Raise your hand. If you right? And it's an interesting thing to think about because, of course, the questions about how self-driving cars should drive are not merely questions about what are the rules of speeding and so forth.
Yes.
But if there's an accident and it's inevitable, there's going to be questions who should get hurt. Should it be the passengers? Should it be the drivers? Should it be the pedestrians or what have you? This decision's going to get made by people who majored in computer science, right? And with all due respect, these are moral questions, and what presumably you need to have are not you're going to get a lot of agreement among us, but you need to have moral philosophers worrying about these issues.
Respond to that, I think there have been cases already where there are these kinds of moral and ethical questions that get put out there, and programmers often do what they do best. They make up a set of rules and hope that they've done the right thing. And they're more often than not overruled, not by philosophers, unfortunately, but by lawyers. Because the real question is, what kind of policies should you put in place so that when a manufacturer wants to develop and sell a self-driving car, what are the policies and rules that it needs to operate under? We've seen many times in the last decade things that we thought as a scientific community were the right thing to do that were overruled based on whether or not there would be liability concerns or not.
And if it's a human who is really driving the car, isn't that human actually absolved of responsibility? Because usually you just don't have time to react anyway. You're not sitting there, well, what should I do here? Because our reaction time is much slower than a machine. So does it introduce more moral complexity in just the most ordinary driving situation to have it directed by a machine?
I think the question about absolution is a difficult one. I mean, on the one hand, the analogy I made to Lori earlier about getting on the airplane, in some sense, she's absolved. It's United Airlines' responsibility. On the other hand, if you knew that the cab driver company, the cab company number one always in cases of accidents, decide to save the men and not the women, at that point you would no longer be absolved of responsibility. Your decision to buy this kind of self-driving car as opposed to that kind of self-driving, you know, Consumer Reports will start having moral grading,
yeah, yeah.
Right?
No, they will. And you know, as a practical matter, that's not going to happen. In other words, once it becomes known enough for you to make a choice when you buy a ticket, it's going to be known and not allowed. I mean, wouldn't you say that's going to be considered discriminatory? And I'm just not sure that's a really valid example.
I don't know. I mean, so we can imagine cases where you would think that if you needed to, you should sacrifice your own life as a driver rather than harm these pedestrians whose it's not their fault. But when word comes out that Volvo is designing their cars to sacrifice the driver, nobody's going to be buying Volvos, right? So it's not the lawyers I'm worried about. It's another part of the company that I think is going to be overriding the ethical decisions.
Let's also make one other part clear. We already turn over some of these decision-making choices to machines.
Right.
Yeah.
Every car that's sold in the U.S. has anti-lock brakes.
Right.
You know what an anti-lock brake is? It's a computer system that every time you step on the brake pedal, you're not actually applying the brakes onto your wheels or the wheel drum. You're actually asking the computer in your car very nicely, please would you put on the brakes? And then it makes the decision based on the road conditions of whether it should apply the brakes or whether it should cycle them and pump them.
It says, Skaz, you haven't ordered anything from Amazon recently.
Yeah. You have to make that choice, yeah.
And then finally, I know you think, Shelley, that we will have a moral obligation someday to the machines we've created?
Yeah. No, that's the point that I was touching on earlier. I mean, I think that you don't owe anything to your cell phone if you want to take out your hammer.
Or even an artificial arm or leg.
Oh, that's right. I was assuming that your cell phone, I don't have a cell phone, but your cell phones, 98% of you have a cell phone, right? I imagine far higher than that. You know, if you take out your hammer and decide to smash it, that's fine. I mean, other than sort of the waste of money, there's no special ethical issue there. But if we really do get to technology that has its own desires, then you can't boss it around.
A big assumption, but we discussed that earlier.
Yeah,
right.
But you can't boss it around anymore. That is to say, morally, you don't have the right to boss. You may have the technological ability, it may be programmed to subsume its interests under yours.
But it's a moral matter.
No, it seems to me that would be wrong.
So, Lori, what's your view on that?
I mean, I think Shelley's right. I mean, you know, even our psychology is built.
So you agree too?
Yeah, I mean, our psychology is built not to harm other agents. In fact, there's lovely data showing how hard it is. You know, if I give you a plastic baby and I say, hey, smash this on the ground, like most of you either will not do it, or if you do that, I can watch your skin conductance response shoot up. Like, and your skin conductance, right? Just kind of like your heartbeat is going to just go crazy. Because, like, even though you know it's a plastic baby, like, your body's built, like, just don't harm things. I think once we get to the point that machines have these capacities, like, we're not going to be able to do that now. I mean, it's hard for us to do it with Alexa, with these robots. When we really get to true personhood, our psychology is going to kick in.
The fact that we could do this to slaves suggests that people can do it to other
people. That's true.
Let's also put out, though, that this is stuff that we're just learning about. You know, the stuff that you saw on the screen, that was a Yale undergraduate who discovered it 8 years ago. We're still learning new things about this all the time and the way that people respond. That's why we have 200 students in the AI class at Yale this semester. This is new and exciting, and that's what we're putting money and excitement into.
Well, I think this has been new and exciting. We are out of time, my little buzzer tells me. And so if everyone will join me in thanking our panelists.
Thank you.
And I think you'd all agree that no AI machine could have simulated that fabulous conversation. So thank you so much. And now Peter Salovey, whom you saw earlier, is going to return with a few thoughts of his own.
So good evening, everyone, and thanks again for joining us this evening. Wasn't that great having Margaret Warner as our moderator and these three fantastic faculty members? It really is wonderful. The faculty members exemplify what it's like to work across disciplinary boundaries, right? Those were three different disciplines represented for us this evening. And their research is a great illustration of the way in which Yale research and Yale scholarship can help us understand current challenges, can help us, in this case, develop the future of artificial intelligence and to make sure that the effects of these developments have a positive impact on human life and on society. So let me share a few of my own thoughts and reactions to this panel, and then, of course, I'd love to hear from you, and we'll get a chance to do that at the reception right after these comments. So tonight we had faculty members from psychology, from computer science, and from philosophy, and they explored what it means to be human in the age of machines. And I kept wondering throughout their interaction, you know, what is it to be an intelligent machine in the age of humans, right? You know, investigators are working across sectors to develop intelligent machines that serve human needs. And unavoidably, it's human intelligence, right, that provides much of the framework and much of the foundation for artificial intelligence. And so I think we have to go back a couple of steps. What does it mean to be intelligent? And of course, at different moments in time, intelligence has been defined in different ways. So let me take a definition that David Wechsler, who is a psychologist who invented many of the IQ tests, that versions of which are still in use that we see today. He defined intelligence as the aggregate or global capacity of individuals to act purposefully, to think rationally, and to deal effectively with the environment. Now, most IQ tests really don't capture this whole definition, not even close. But the definition has the advantage of being broad enough to encompass a wide array of human abilities, including emotional intelligence. And I think many of you know, did any of you take psychology with me? Oh, great, this is pretty good, about 15% of you. Thank you. That's not bad. You know that emotional intelligence is an idea that came out of work that I did with Jack Mayer. And we felt that theories of intelligence never really had a place for emotion. And at the same time, emotion researchers never had much interest in how humans differ. right? And so we took both of these shortcomings, I would say, and proposed the idea of emotional intelligence. And we began by asking, if there's an emotional intelligence, what would the skills be? If there was an emotional intelligence, how would it help people? And we wrote a paper about this in 1990, and that was really the beginning of the idea of emotional intelligence. At the time, nobody cited it. It took 5 years for one person to cite that paper. Isn't that amazing? It's now the most cited paper I've written, and the journal it was published in, it's the most cited paper they ever published. But it just shows you how science works. 5 years and nothing happened. Then a best-selling book came out, not written by me, but cited that paper, and life changed. Anyway, it's sort of an interesting idea of how science works. Anyway, subsequently, we went on to think about what would be the skills involved in emotional intelligence. We talked about four sets of skills: understanding, perceiving emotions in yourself, perceiving emotions in other people, understanding your emotions, how they change over time, how they blend together, what causes them, what relieves them, managing your emotions, managing the emotions of other people, right? And most importantly, the ability to use your emotions to help you think more rationally, to help you solve problems, right? In this model, emotions are a source of data. They help us think. They help us make decisions. They help us be more creative. They help us solve problems. And that was the key insight, that just like our five senses, seeing, hearing, tasting, what have you, emotions provide data. And that data is useful to us. It helps us in daily interactions. It's like a sixth sense. So we figured out that if you can measure individual differences and people's ability to access those data, that would be an emotional intelligent quotient, an EQ. Some people are indeed much better at this than other people are. So here's the question relevant to our panel today. Can software be created that masters the skills of emotional intelligence? Now, I actually believe this is possible, and I believe we've already seen progress in this area. So the U.S. Navy invented a robot called Octavia. The robot is humanoid, like SCAS's robots. It fights fires. That's what it's designed to do. But when it sees a teammate on the firefighting team, it looks pleased. When it doesn't understand something that the human says to it, it actually looks confused, right? And that helps with the interaction with the human. We have an undergraduate and a graduate student and a medical student at Yale working together to develop an app that will detect changes in your facial expression and changes in your voice quality when you're talking to your phone that might be signals of depression or other mood disorders, right? And so through interacting with the app might be able to give you feedback that you might want to talk to someone you seem to be more depressed, or maybe you might want to exercise, or you might have missed your medication if you're on antidepressants or what have you, right? Very clear that it's using emotional information. It's being emotionally intelligent. But we have to recognize that machines have some shortcomings. First of all, emotions and emotional intelligence as a human trait was selected for through thousands and thousands of years of natural selection, right? We don't have that advantage with machines. Emotions also have a physiological component, right? When we're afraid, our heart rate increases, certain hormones like cortisol or adrenaline course through our body. A little hard to see what the machine equivalent to those physiological reactions are. But I'm actually confident, nonetheless, that someday we're going to see machines that can master emotional intelligence. And these machines could be invaluable. They could be invaluable in helping us care for people with physical illnesses, people with mental illnesses. They can help us complete chores. They can conduct dangerous work like fighting fires as part of a team. They'll become a part of our daily lives. And so the question is, and you saw it reflected tonight, the question is, how will humans perceive and interact with these intelligent machines. Well, we know, and you saw it tonight, that when people use a smart device, they often behave as if they're interacting with a human, right? Rather than a device. In fact, people interact with a virtual character like Siri the same way, whether they think that voice or that humanoid figure is being controlled by a human or being controlled by an algorithm. They actually don't care, right? They interact in exactly the same way. Now, if that robot or that or Siri or what have you engage in a social way or show an emotion or do something like cheat, then all of a sudden we think it's trustworthy or not, it's supportive or not. We start to really ascribe human characteristics to it. So I think as physical and virtual machines become smarter emotionally and intellectually, we're going to trust them more, and they're going to change society. They're going to change our lives. Well, right now, this kind of machine intelligence is being created all around the world. And as creators of machine intelligence, we have to consider, are we benefiting humans? Are we benefiting society? And the complexities in that questions, the complexities in designing an intelligent machine that has a positive impact on society is one that a single discipline is not going to be able to solve working by itself. So you're going to need, yes, leaders in engineering and computer science like SCAS. You're going to need scientists. You're going to need social and behavioral scientists, right, like Laurie. But you're also going to need humanists like Shelley, who philosophers and artists who think about the human impact of these advances. And this is where a research university can play an important role. It's where Yale can play a really important role. We can bring together experts. We can break down the barriers between disciplines. We can convene people in order to address just these kinds of questions. And in fact, we're doing that. We're conducting important research across fields, and we're getting it all to talk to each other in ways that help our students also become agile thinkers, develop into the kinds of leaders that are going to be needed in tomorrow's world. Individuals will thrive in a changing society. And they'll go on. They'll go on to make important contributions to their professions. They'll go on to make important contributions to their communities. And they'll do what Yale alumni have done for many, many generations. They will do what you all do every day. And your efforts as Yale alumni end up reaching every part of the world. You demonstrate that Yale's enriching educational environment extends far beyond New Haven, right? You know that for us to address global challenges, like the ones we talked about this evening, we have to broaden our horizons. And so how does that happen? Well, when you share your wisdom, when you direct talented students or potential faculty members to Yale, you help accomplish that. But also when you serve your communities, you're setting an example for our students, for young people throughout the world. So I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all that you do to provide such a great example to our students. I want to thank you for all that you do to extend the reach of Yale, to be ambassadors for Yale. And I want to thank you for coming this evening to our Yale Explorers event. I look forward to seeing you at the reception and hearing your reactions to what you heard tonight and hearing your thoughts about anything happening at Yale. In the meantime, well, almost anything. In the meantime, can you join me in one more round of applause for Margaret and our three professors tonight? They were great. They were great. So we are going to go right back out where we came from and have more sushi and have another drink. And I look forward to greeting you personally. Thanks for being here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, please be sure to post your thoughts on this evening to #YaleExplores. Thank you.